So thank you, Sarah, so much for your willingness to join us today by Zoom to talk about the remarkable sort of theological legacy and to many people, the kind of forgotten, if not, you know, largely never known legacy of Dorothea Zola. I've just had such a, I'm so grateful for connecting with you. You know, we talked on the phone a few days ago, just in preparation for this. We discovered so many kind of deep theological and personal interconnections. And so I'm glad that, you know, even at late career and mid-career, in your case, we have begun a conversation. So to those of you who don't know Dr. Sarah Pennock, she is a professor of contemporary religious thought at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. We have a Waco person right here and an Oklahoman right there, so we're kind of in the neighborhood. Sarah was born in New Orleans, and I'm thinking around, what, 1968, 67, you don't have to say, where her father, the theologian, the Baptist theologian, and quite influential sort of evangelical thinker, Clark Pennock, was teaching theology at the seminary at the time. I think when you were four or five, your family moved back to their native Canada, and you, your dad was teaching at Regent's College, Vancouver, if I'm not mistaken, and eventually, 6 or 7 years later, at least for your high school years, your father was at McMaster University in the Toronto area, which is where you grew up, and also where you did your undergraduate and your master's degree. You made your way onto Yale University and did your PhD in philosophical theology under the brilliant tutelage of Louis Dupré and, you know, among many other luminaries. I was thrilled to learn that part of your research at the dissertation stage was made possible by, was it a DAAD or a Fulbright, some kind of
Yes, DAAD.
DAAD that took you to Hamburg, where, and you're going to tell us more about this, Dr. Pennock, you got to know Dorothea Zola, were active in some, I don't know, research or assistant capacity. And I think at that point, you know, began to reckon seriously with her complicated and I think, you know, brilliant theological vision, her and the promise of her vision, which we're still, I think, reckoning with. And your research on Zola and more broadly on Christian responses to the Holocaust culminated in your doctoral dissertation, and then, as you know, we try to do in academia, a revision of some sort that led to your first book called Beyond Theodicy: Jewish and Continental Christian Continental Thinkers Respond to the Holocaust, which I just got in the mail this week and am enjoying immensely. I guess you joined the faculty at Trinity University in 2000 after teaching for a couple of years at UCal Chico, Chico State, where you met my former classmate here, Joel Zimmelman. And in 2006 or seven, you received, thank you so much, a Fulbright visiting professorship to the Latvian University in Riga. We have learned so much from your books, the Theology of Dorothea Zola, which is a remarkable edited volume with some, you know, I mean, this is like the who's who of feminist, you know, and sort of liberationist thought in the early aughts, and your book, Facing Death, Confronting Mortality and the Holocaust and Ourselves. And I really appreciate the clarity that you bring to the task of interpreting Zola's thought. You know, she wrote often for a popular audience. And of course, at the Project on Lived Theology, we are very big champions of writing theology in a style that's accessible and engaging. And yet there's something about the, I mean, you say I have all of her books stacked around the room, about the kind of the totality of her thought that is not easy to kind of recast in some kind of, you know, systematic way. She wasn't a systematic theologian. And so we're really grateful for your presence today and look forward to sort of getting a clear sense on how to think about this remarkable mind and particularly against the sorts of, you know, uncertainties of the present hour. So welcome virtually to the University of Virginia, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm really delighted to join the class and to talk about Zola. I'll start with who she was and what she stood for, and then proceed to look at her mysticism and particularly the silent cry. Zola was born in 1929 in Cologne, Germany, and she was a child and a teenager during the war. She grew up enamored with German literature, especially the poetry of Goethe, Rilke, and Hölderlin. After the war, she felt that German culture had removed her inner life from political events, and she regretted the romanticism of German literature. She raised the question, how could anyone love Bach in a world of torture? After the war, she discovered that her father was one-quarter Jewish, and she continued to reflect on the perpetrators and victims of World War II throughout her career. It also made her committed to German Jewish Christian gatherings up until the time I knew her, when we attended one together. For me, as a professor with children, I admired her marriage with three children, and her second marriage with a child, her combination of work, publication, and motherhood. She traveled a great deal in the 1960s to Israel, where she met Martin Buber in person. And quotes from his work and his writings are a theme continually, including in the book that you've read. She also traveled in the 1970s to Vietnam to look at communism and to consider the features of the Vietnam War. And she was active in the anti-war movement. Then later, she traveled extensively in Latin America and became interested in Nicaragua. She went to South America. And during her time at Union, she was engaged in issues of Latin American revolution and the hopes for a socialist government. The question of why Zola, I think Charles posed that to me. Why would I want to study Zola? How did I come to her work? It happened as a graduate student. I was writing a dissertation. I wanted to write out the problem of evil. And then I got interested in suffering, the experience of victims, as a theological question. And I discovered Zola's book entitled Suffering, which I found one of the most powerful theological responses to the Holocaust. And in this book, she also explored mystical approaches to suffering. I also took from her book Objections to Theodicy, which worked into my dissertation that was mentioned, which was a look at objections to theodicy based on Holocaust reflection. And that led me in an anti-theodicy direction, seeing theodicy as a moral scandal to justify the suffering of victims. I met Zola for the first time at the AAR. She was there in person in the 90s. Fortress Press would invite her because they were publishing a sequence of books in translation. And so I was delighted to meet her sitting on a stool at the Fortress booth the year that they released her 1995 book, Theology for Skeptics, Reflections on God. I think another factor that drew me to Sola may have been my evangelical theological father and my evangelical roots. I think I found Zola an ecumenical figure, an inclusive figure, and someone who was seeking the authenticity of faith, and the experience of faith. And I believe that was something I also grew up with, in an evangelical context. Zola, when I ask myself what would I say about her in the first person, often you can tell by anecdotes about someone's life what mattered to them, what they were all about. Here are some observations from my year with her in Germany. She had boundless energy. She was a devoted grandmother. She didn't cook much. We would have bread and cheese suppers together, which she absolutely relished. She fully embraced her role as a writer, a thinker, and a speaker. She loved to sing. She would attend church choir and rehearse, which was, I thought, a very traditional activity. She loved the poetry of hymns, the tunes. She also liked to swim regularly. She had healthy habits. From myself and from her other friends, I've heard that she would burn the candle at both ends, so to speak. She attended large numbers of gatherings. She never said no to an invite if she could help it. She was not known for sparing her health. When she did have a health setback, she would push forward with her activities. I heard this from colleagues at Union, like Bev Harrison, and they were very struck by how involved she was in all sorts of public and social events. Also, from her time at Union Seminary, which was in the 70s and 80s, she was known for her outspokenness, and I also noticed that she was not afraid to say something. She attacked the capitalist system while at Union in a talk that was given in front of donors to the university, which was a bit embarrassing. She attacked Wall Street, calling it a beast from the abyss. She coined the term Christo-fascism, and apparently she also used this against a guest at Union, where she felt that Christ was being co-opted into what she called a magical symbol rather than a poor man who was tortured to death. I had a chance to visit her home a number of times and to have dinner with her and her husband, Fulbert Stefanski. Fulbert was had a position as a professor at Uni Hamburg in the pedagogic or education department. And at the time I knew her, she had just published The Silent Cry in German. It hadn't yet been translated into English. And what she most wanted to talk about was mysticism. Another personal anecdote, but also an enigma I had with her, was her role as a woman in German theology and wondering what it was that prevented her from holding a position in a German university. She was never a professor in Germany, only in the United States. When I took a seminar at Uni Hamburg, we did read her writings, and I was impressed to see that. It was in a seminar on women's theology. And the interesting was that Zola didn't really feel that she was a symbol of women's theology or feminism. Her first concern was not women's rights or advancement, it was German accountability for the Holocaust. And the systems of evil, the institutional systems in the world. She was concerned about economic inequality, class inequality, socialism. She was she would critique capitalism and was interested in kind of really, bold critiques of the economic system. I think her position as a fairly privileged white woman made her rather uninterested in women's rights until later in her career when she was in the US and took a different perspective on how feminism connected with other forms of liberation. She was doing a set of lectures at the university when I was there, and it was based on her book, The Breaking the Ice of the Soul, and it was on theology and literature. And she loved Sting very much. She would play music by Sting. She would analyze the lyrics. She would play other popular music. She would go back to poetry. And it was a very full lecture, and it wasn't a theology faculty seminar. It was a talk for any student, for the public. And I was struck by it really represented who her audience was. And she her highest hopes, I think, were that she would have an audience that was beyond the church, beyond Protestants, and have a comprehensive voice. I would say that her audience in the 1990s was students who were disillusioned with the church, but open to creative and socially active theology. I'll turn now to looking at themes connected with The Silent Cry. The cover of the book in German, I like very much. The translator flip-flopped the title and the subtitle. So in German, the title is Mysticism and Resistance, and The Silent Cry is the subtitle. My approach will be to look at how major works throughout her career, this is like an overview of what she wrote about, more or less chronologically. I'll be talking about The Silent Cry in connection with major works to help you understand how her theology is coherent. And that this book is not a new departure into mysticism, but accumulation. She was very famous for her first book because it had Death of God in the title. It connected her immediately with the American Death of God movement and authors like Richard Rubinstein. And in around 1966, Time magazine in the US had a cover on the Death of God in it. It made a sensation. This particular book, though, was kind of hatched independently of the other writers in the US. It wasn't in dialogue with them until after it was published. But this was her reflection on what it means, it's her Christology. She uses the word representative, which is Stellvertretung, to articulate the role of Christ for us. Zola's mysticism and Christology responds to critiques of modernity. God is not the explanation for scientific unknowns or what Bonhoeffer calls the God of the gaps. She also rejected God, the image of God as the ruler of history. She rejected the idea that God could allow or plan or permit the Holocaust. She held that God cannot do that. That would make God a sadist. In Stellvertretung, she makes it clear that in traditional theism, God must change. God is not separate from the world. He does not just intervene at will to alter the course of events. She thinks that the traditional concept of God is responsible for continuing secularization. Zola proposes a non-theistic Christology that opens up a vision of God in which God is dependent and our actions represent God in the world. Christ's work is not, if we do not assent to be representative, that's Christ's role. We are each unique contributors to the work of God in the world. Zola writes that the incarnation of God continues in the world, and the Christic power is still alive through us human beings. Christ is present in our solidarity with one another in suffering and in struggle. In leaving classical theism behind, we become subjects involved in this process of change and transformation. We learn cooperation rather than wait for things to come to us from on high. These are all elements of mystical piety. Her Christology then is not a traditional Lutheran one. It's a Christology that challenges traditional theism. In the Silent Cry, I would notice that Christology is absent, almost absent. It's a question why in her book on mysticism there isn't a role for any sustained reflection on Jesus Christ. Instead, examples are given from Christians, but many religions. I would respond that claims about radical incarnation and radical immanence run throughout the Silent Cry, and they ground it politically. I think her examples from the writings of Christian mystics and liberation thinkers do have a Christological import, and I think they represent Christ as incarnate in the lives of those who work for resistance. It seems that Sola moves away from doctrinal reflection in the Silent Cry to address an interreligious and pluralistic audience. This particular book I would draw attention to because it also helps you see what makes her a radical theologian. In our present age, Zola thinks that the God of theism is no longer valid, and the language of theology must evolve. God is not almighty, God is not in heaven, God is not a spectator. A way that Zola responds by kind of transforming theism is in looking at dialogical language. And here she takes from a Jewish philosopher, Martin Buber. She fondly recalls a pivotal conversation with Martin Buber where in person, where she introduces herself and he asks her, "What do you do?" She replies, "I teach theology." And then he paused, which seemed like a long time for her. And then he replied dryly, "Oh, theology, how do you do that?" And Zola, this was unforgettable for Zola because she already had a radical direction. So she had to kind of consider what her response was. She agreed with Buber when she hears a quote from Zola, "Religious language destroys itself if it talks about God in the I-it relationship." God isn't an object, is her point. God's not over and against us, as separate. And then she heard the quote continues. "Emancipation does not mean only to get rid of the oppressive colonialist and to be freed from God who imprisons us. It also has to be positively stated. We have to talk about our freedom for a different God." Mysticism happens, she writes in The Silent Cry, mysticism happens when the I steps forth from its self-imposed and imagined limits. What Zola calls atheistic faith is similar in a way to Bonhoeffer's religionless Christianity in his letters and papers from prison. Like Bonhoeffer, Zola is disappointed in the institutional church. She's disappointed by the church's response to Nazism. She's equally disappointed from the church's ineffective responses to political and social injustices in her lifetime. She believes that the church should not be centered on salvation in an escapist way. I think she would agree with Bonhoeffer's world come of age, where reassurances of dogma do not comfort us today. In the post-war era, Sola was convinced that for ordinary people, the language of the church and theology has run dry. She also agrees the church should be a community of solidarity and resistance, and suffering connects the world with Christ. She asks in the question, a powerful question, how does our pain become God's pain? How is God's pain our own pain? The first book I read by Zola was Suffering, And I can briefly say it reinforced to me problems with classical theism, such as the idea of God as omnipotent. Zola fully rejected a traditional view of God's omnipotence and felt that the concept of God in itself needed to change, and that the Holocaust was an illustration of why theism needed to be reformulated. Zola was against theodicy, which she thought made God into an agent of suffering. According to Zola, suffering was not always spiritual and not always meaningful. I think in The Silent Cry, she emphasizes the spiritual meaning of suffering. But in her original book, Suffering, she spends quite a bit of time saying that suffering can be useless, pointless, and just simply destructive. She writes at length about not glorifying suffering. Her concern with the Holocaust led her to also reflect on perpetrators of suffering. And in her own society, she looked at institutions of the military, business, and government. In her last book, on The Silent Cry, she has a section where she speaks about moving from being Christocentric to focusing on the spirit. That she believes that the spirit or the ruah is a better term for God, and that was part of her kind of her theism after the Holocaust, which also connects with her interest in affinities with Jewish thought. Connected with the death of God theme in her first book, she considers in the book Suffering that God is present, God has no other hands but ours, and God and humanity is mutually dependent. I think the silent cry can be interpreted as a cry, like a cry of possibly a cry of suffering, as well as a cry to God. Zola wrote a number of books that dealt with political or liberation theology. She's associated with political German theologians, Jürgen Moltmann and Johann Baptist Metz, who are also post-Holocaust German theologians. In her book, Thinking About God, she has kind of a typology from Orthodox, like a three-part typology, starting with Orthodox or traditional, like, let's say, Lutheran theology. Taking the step to political theology, no, I mean to liberal theology, and then to political or liberation theology. And she believes that that's kind of a necessary progression within theology. So her thinking about resistance is wrapped up with thinking about adjusting the concept of God and also rethinking what it means for Christians. And to be involved in politics, or in what way Christian faith is inherently political. She typifies liberal theology, which she represents by authors like Paul Tillich or Rudolf Bultmann. She believes liberal theology seeks timeless truths and a kind of a kernel of theology, such as love or symbolism or existential kerygma. And she feels that liberal theology cannot be appropriately political. And so the German theology of the war period in Germany has to be moved beyond. So some of Zola's comments then about political theology is that it needs to look at the perspective of the poor and the oppressed. It needs to look at issues of race and class and gender. She has a section on Black theology and thinking about God, and reflects on whether God is white, whether God is male, how we imagine God. And she traces the influence of Martin Luther King Jr. to James Cone and his like Black theology, which she considers a branch of liberation theology. Her mysticism is practical, and it is above all political. She asks, what difference does God make? What difference does Jesus make in how I live? If you can't answer that question, what difference does it make with a political relevant answer? Then she believes it's a disappointment. It has failed. She says that theology must be active and relevant or nothing at all. A quote from The Silent Cry is that resistance is not the outcome of mysticism. Resistance is mysticism itself. And so she's very concerned to weave resistance into theology very thoroughly. Another aspect of her thought is that she challenges the language of theology, and she tends toward literature, and she includes a number of kind of versions of literature. She was a poet, a published poet from early on, from the 60s. She published poetry when she was at Union. If she went to like an activist event or a po yeah, or a you know a group event, she would often read a poem of hers as her kind of statement. Her poems were intended to kind of to communicate her theological insights and to look at particular situations. So there was poesy, which is poetry. She also believed that prayer is its own language of theology. So she makes some interesting moves as far as what is theological speech. She thought that prayer also it relates to Martin Buber and I Thou and the idea that speaking about God is secondary to speaking to God. And so there's kind of a pious kind of sense that theology is meant to be connected with relationship. She would consider scripture like a literary text, parables, narratives. I mean, in the Bible, she considers like reading the Bible in a literary way is helpful. She was also very fond of German fairy tales and folk tales and would often use them in her theology. She would quote Goethe frequently. She would quote German hymns, which were poetry. She had not at all left the church behind. She was not at all an atheist, but she was a radical. And I think in terms of literature, her radicalism involved rejecting traditional theology. She insisted that theology and faith and ethics need to change for the 21st century. And the Holocaust to her was continual proof of that. But she would always draw parallels between the Holocaust and other forms of mass death or atrocity or injustice. She'd never wanted to compartmentalize the Holocaust, but the Holocaust was an example of what can continue in various forms. A quote from her about language, she wrote, "For me, praying and writing poetry, prayers and poems are not alternatives. The message I wish to pass on is meant to encourage people to learn to speak for themselves." She presupposes that all people are poets. And that when people try to speak about religion, about what really concerns them, they are kind of expressing their own poetry of prayer. In The Silent Cry, she has two chapters which I think relate to ecology. She wrote a book on a theology of creation. I think in The Silent Cry, there's a chapter on nature and a chapter on eroticism. And I think this shows her reflection on the earth. Zola bridges monotheism and pantheism using mystical examples. Her work and her life connected her with ecology. She regularly attended protests, anti-nuclear protests, which was a major movement in Germany in the 1970s. And the transportation of nuclear waste in Germany involved people blocking trains and having like nonviolent sit-ins. She connected her activism also with being against the military establishment. I also think her marriage reflected her embrace of creation. She delighted so much in her children and her grandchildren, and there was a sense that like her love for her family was also a sign of kind of hope for the future. In Liberation, she wrote a number of books. I think the books reflect her the importance of hope in her thought. In The Silent Cry, she has a section on Martin Luther King Jr., and I realize your class has studied some of his writings and sermons. In her chapter on nonviolence, she mentions not seeing Martin Luther King initially as a mystic, but she describes his experience at his kitchen table when he was fearing for his life in Montgomery. She speaks of it as a dark night of the soul where King spoke to God in prayer to say that he had nothing left. And King heard an inner voice telling him to stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth. God will never leave you. And so Zola expresses this as an absence of fear. She quotes him, "I no longer needed a gun, nor have I been afraid." There's like a power of resistance in nonviolence, and that there's a strong continuity. In The Silent Cry, I'd say it was her magnum opus because it's her longest book. It's the closure to her career. She intended it as such, and she only had one book published after her death. And I also think that it's a recognition that in her work, as I've described to you, there are mystical threads that that deserve to be, you know, to be woven together, and which she does. I find similarities between her work and Johann Baptist Metz's work, a Catholic German theologian, on the political and mystical sides of resistance. Her book about death that was published, she died in 2003, and it came out in the same year based on an almost finished manuscript. I think that her reflection on mysticism in a moving way led to her reflection on her own mortality. And so I think The Silent Cry deals with mysticism as a form of resistance, but she also saw mysticism as a way of coping with death and as a way of embracing death. Some critical questions I want to raise that you may have wondered about as you read the book. Zola combines many different religions, many different traditions. And one of the questions I had as soon as I saw this book was, how do they relate? Is she saying that all of the authors, whether it's a Muslim author or a Buddhist author or a Native American author or poetry and Latin American writing, she takes it all, she brings it together. So it raises a question of theological pluralism. And based on The Silent Cry, I would say she does seem to subscribe to pluralism, which would be that there's truth in all religions. And further, pluralists believe that there's, according to my definition, that there's kind of a divine or a transcendent that's behind the religions. So that accounts for how all religions have an aspect of truth. I think that the majority of authors in the book are Christian, and I see her worldview or her mysticism as a Christian form of mysticism. I don't think she would say that all the religions are the same in the book. I don't think she would say that religions don't have historical and cultural differences. However, she doesn't make any sort of philosophical justification or theological, you know, rationale for the combining of religions. I would say that she has faith that many different mystics reach for the same mystery. And I'd say what she's looking for in mysticism is resistance. I wonder about the dehistoricization of mysticism in the book. And that goes along with pluralism. It seems to be like a leveling of the examples used to make the points that kind of that fit into her framework. The scholarship on mysticism, I mean, is very, very critical of dehistoricized treatments, but Zola doesn't reply to that type of criticism. Another last question, I suppose, that is the question about democratizing mysticism. And at the end of The Silent Cry, there's a section where Zola and her husband have a debate, and he's a Catholic. And so from his point of view, mysticism is like a special form of faith, like a very highly developed form of faith. It's not what every person experiences. It's not faith for everyone. And so he and Zola have an argument about it, which I find very endearing. Fulbert says that it seems she's making mysticism kind of an everyday thing, whereas he thinks maybe what she's talking about is it's sort of a piety, but not a full mysticism. And I think that she broadens mysticism a great deal in the book. And I find that a challenging kind of project, which goes beyond her kind of her aims as a liberation theologian. What does a radical theology of resistance look like? I adore Zola's pictures. This is so much so as I remember her. She was a radical. And I have some points for you to reflect on as I'm getting near to the end. I'd say that these six things are all vital elements of resistance. How you understand God, and as I mentioned, she understands God in a more an open or a more flexible way. She believes that suffering must, within her theology, within mysticism, suffering can have a positive valoration. She believes that hope is central and hope is fueled by faith. She sees solidarity as something that is part of community. And she also connects that with her Marxist point of view. She considers she was a Marxist, like a admitted Marxist in the 70s, and I don't think she fully left it behind. Solidarity is solidarity for workers, for the poor, for against capitalism. The language of I thou and the language of poetry are also ingredients. She thinks that there has to be a sense of looking to God. There has to be a sense of this world, hope and solidarity, and the ability to express it in a way that can communicate to people today. One of her most moving statements comes at the end of The Mystery of Death, where she writes that, "I believe in life after death, the life that continues after my individual death. I believe in the peace that will perhaps exist someday when I'm long dead. I believe in justice and in joy." A young woman once asked me, this is Zola, "Do you think everything is over when we die?" And I replied, "It depends on what you mean by everything. If everything is what is there for you yourself, then yes, everything is over. If not, then everything lives on." As a lovely Yiddish song puts it, and she quotes, "Mir leben ewig, we live forever." And this is what she wrote the year before her own death. Not only does resistance need mysticism, she also believed that religion itself needed to be centrally mystical. Zola predicts that mysticism is the future. She speaks to Christians, and I believe also post-Christians and non-Christians, who are seeking a vision of resistance that is social, pluralistic and socially engaged. Her writings inspire resistance, strengthened by mysticism and the belief that the world can be different. And I will stop there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And
Thank
I'd
you.
be happy to discuss.
And I would like to note, before we move into the discussion, how exceedingly helpful that was. And also that we have a virtual visitor who you introduced me to by name in our conversation on Tuesday. And that's now Dr. Lauren Larkin, who finished her PhD. It was at University of Aberdeen or Nottingham in May. And you were on the dissertation committee. And I think you were working with Philip Ziegler. Is that correct, Lauren?
Yes, I defended on April 19th. My advisors, Philip Ziegler and Dr. Pinnock, was my external examiner. That's and it was fun. University of Aberdeen.
It's lovely meeting you. So I know you're all luminaries out there in the virtual world, but I just recognized your name from our very brief email exchange. What kind of questions do you have? I mean, there's so many directions we can move in. And I know you all had some questions that you formulated for this time. Would you like to get started? I thought just your first question, Marshall, was an interesting way to sort of move into the book.
Which one was that?
The first question that you asked in your written summaries.
Yeah, just I asked three. So.
Okay, this had to do with the title.
The title of this book?
Yeah.
Yeah, my question was kind of just, we read chapters 11 to 15, so I felt like it was an amazing read, but a lot of it, I found out that like chapters 1 to 5 is when she outlined what mysticism really was and what the silent cry was. So a lot of it, I was kind of just feeling a little bit confused about what she was really explaining. And I get my first question that I wrote for our submission before this class was just like about the oxymoron between the silent cry and what you think she was trying to get with that.
I like that question. It also connects with her sense of literary and poetic language of theology. She considers that like a poetic expression. I think she means it to indicate the kind of how mysticism exceeds language. I see it, one way to see it is that silent is when words can't capture the reality. And so the silent cry, I think, is like it's a sign of ineffability and the kind of the mystery of God. And that it also makes me think of her work on suffering in the Holocaust and the sense of like a cry of agony, like a cry of pain that's also like even bereft of voice, like cannot be voiced. So I guess I see it in a theistic way, and then in a theme of suffering too.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Two of you had questions about the theme of egolessness, particularly in relation to suffering and vulnerability and resistance. Would you like to sort of recast your questions for Dr. Pinnock?
Sure. Mine was kind of how is it, I guess, similar and different from asceticism as she like explains when she described egolessness, it sounded a lot like asceticism to me, so I was a little confused about how she views egolessness as like valuable, but I think asceticism as not super helpful. I don't know.
And then your question sort of pair nicely. Would you want to just sort of?
Yeah. And then my question was, how is her concept of egolessness helpful in a context where maybe the people, the oppressed, are being stripped of their individuality and self-identity against their will? So in a case where you don't have agency, how do you think about egolessness?
Those are two really great angles to look at what she means. I can see that like egolessness appears to be self-abasing, and I think that's not what Zola intended it to be. When she uses egolessness, I think she's looking at the kind of the role, the relationship of the person to God, and even mystical ideas of like withdrawing the self in order to give more space for God, that like there's a sense that the ego is self-centered and it's an obstacle. So egolessness has to do partly with kind of renouncing your own privileges and individuality. And it's also kind of language of negative theology from Meister Eckhart and others that she quotes. But asceticism, isn't, I think she's making the distinction. She doesn't approve of asceticism, but she does approve of voluntary suffering. And I think that could be kind of a fine line, really. But she believes that voluntary suffering is suffering for like suffering for others or suffering for like because of an inevitability, and not just welcoming it for, you know, to prove who, you know, your mystical power. For as far as liberation goes, I think in a context of liberation, she would substitute the ego for the community. And she would want to kind of talk about solidarity and like the voice of the community as present, and she sees the ego as something individual. And I think the point about agency is a really good one. And I think it's part of like the way that Zola kind of like generalizes about mysticism, that she generalizes in a way that assumes that people can live in a mystical way that gives up their individuality for the, you know, for the collective. And she may be, that may be like a question mark for the process of resistance.
Yeah, and I think one of the most moving and for me helpful essays, chapters in all of Zola is that opening chapter in Suffering called Critique of Christian Masochism. I've used that in a book I wrote on religion and anxiety, but I think that offers the kind of affirmation of a robust, integral personhood. So she's not insinuating in any way this kind of trope of Christian sort of masochism or self abnegation, in my estimation. But that's helpful to see the connection you make between or the contrast you make between the ego and community. I want to have one more question right now from the group and then open up some time for our visitors. Would one of you like to ask a question? Lydia? Gavin? Joseph, what about your third question, Joseph? I like that. That was an interesting question. All your questions were interesting.
One of my questions after the reading, would Zola advocate for like the use of this world's powers, like being advertisement, money, or like a hierarchical system to bring justice? Or would she always advocate for the movement toward justice being through subversive means that aren't using the systems in existence? Does that make sense? Like, okay.
Yeah. More like your second, more the second option, but whether it's subversive, I don't know if that's, but what it would be kind of would be going against institutions, going against the domination, like what she would see as the powers of domination, which would include government, business, military, like, and kind of like a, she really had a sense that overall, there's a really large danger coming from powerful institutions with profit motives. And so, yeah, so she would say like marches, resistance, like she met the Berrigan brothers, who were famous for pouring blood on Vietnam draft cards, or like kind of trying to break into to kind of to commit acts of civil disobedience. Thank you.
May I open this conversation up to our guests? Who would like to ask a question or propose an idea, thought?
I'm interested to know if is she read in Germany now, and how is she received, or how is she thought of?
And who is this asking the question?
Karen Wright Marsh. LOL. Hello.
Hello.
I didn't see you.
Yeah.
Can I just say, Karen, this is my wife, Karen. I think I was telling you this the other day. I'm not trying to answer the question for you, but when we lived in Berlin the last time in 2010, one of my hosts, our host, was Helmut Reiland. And his wife, Erica, who had been the president of the Kirchentag for several years. But Helmut had been the head of patents in Germany, and he was a patron to a lot of the sort of Protestant church goings on in the early aughts. And I remember having coffee with him one of our first weeks there in the beautiful apartment in Steglitz. And I asked Helmut, who most closely resembles Dietrich Bonhoeffer in your mind in the current German scene? And his first response was Dorothee Zola. She is, in all kinds of striking ways, a kind of exemplification of that theological path. Anyway, I just thought I would contribute that before Sarah gives a much more nuanced answer.
Yes, she is read, and particularly by lay people, I think there's a lot of interest in what she stands for. But my own anecdote is that I was at a Holocaust colloquium this summer, just this year, and I met a German theologian who did his training with Johann Baptist Metz, who I mentioned, on like mysticism and politics. And his name is Jürgen Mannemann, and he said that he also writes kind of a radical direction, but he quotes Zola in his books, and he was actually encouraging me to publish something else on Zola, because because she speaks to today. And so yeah, so there, I mean, there are Germans also who think about Zola, but as much as Zola is countercultural in terms of her critique of, of society, she also is countercultural in theological terms too. So establishment theologians would tend to find her just, too free. Not abiding by, church doctrine, because she didn't think that doctrine should remain unchanged. I think if doctrine can be expressed with I thou, or in dialogue, or in prayer, or in poetry, or literary language, that's where doctrine should be today, but not in a not in a kind of in an old form or, you know, traditional wording. She wasn't wedded to tradition unless it could be fresh.
Lydia, I really liked your first question because I had the same question, and it comes from the our reading in The Silent Cry. Would you like to kind of restate that? Or Dr. Bennett?
Yeah, I believe you mentioned this in the earlier chapter. I would love for you to just explain what this really means. The phrase was, God is a nothing that seeks to be everything. And yeah, I think I was just a little confused on that aspect, because it seems like the whole point of mysticism is to magnify like the presence of God in your life. And so what does it mean that he would be the nothing that seeks to be everything?
That's a really interesting quote. And often mysticism is looked at as being having kind of a positive side and a negative side. The positive is what we know of God and God as, you know, present in love. And the negative side is like God being absent or God withdrawing or maybe God being silent. And so for Zola, that statement is one aspect of mysticism. It's not the entirety, but she does think that there's a sense that God, because God and humanity are mutually interactive, then God's withdrawal could also be part of him. Humanity's like stepping forward, almost like God stepping back, humanity stepping forward, or let's say like kind of the given again, like this, the I thou metaphor works for her. Like if someone is there, then you're there, and if they move backwards, then you move forwards, or like she thinks that mystics do have experiences of nothingness. And that God can be found in the darkness as well as in the light. It's part of mystical paradox. I hope that helps a bit. That's an excellent question, which is very about mysticism as a whole.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Very helpful.
Thanks.
Melissa, where are you calling from?
My dark study in Charlottesville.
Okay. Hey.
I'm from Mississippi, I think, is where he's going. I just got back from there. I'm not a theologian, but I did read her work years ago, and I tuned in today because I've liked the programs that Charles and Karen have done, but also particularly because of the idea of Christian fascism and the relationship. Maybe you could speak to this, that to Christian nationalism and our current state and state to be in our country. I was just wondering, Sarah, if you were talking with her today or if she were talking with us about our situation, our country, what would be the questions she would be asking or the points she would be making or the guidance she might be giving to people of faith, any faith? And is this a relationship, the Christian fascism and the Christian nationalism? Is it? It sounds like the same thing to me, but I'm not nuanced in these ways.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's the whole question. I just want a few solutions for next week.
I'd be happy to solve the situation.
Can you fix us?
Oh gosh. She would most certainly agree that the Christian white nationalism is a form of Christo-fascism. That would fit that would fit into her critique very, very easily. So she would have a lot to say about power, about church power, political power, how power feeds into power. And she would, you know, she would also, yeah, she would consider like the theology of the church and how the disappointing the church is. So yeah, she would, what she says about the church during her lifetime is, would transfer to ours very, very smoothly. She's prescient. Then another part of the question that interests me though is like, what does anyone do? Particularly someone with hope, like she has hope. She, you know, she resists. She is a, you know, is a mystic. What does that contribute? And I think she would, well, first of all, she would advocate resistance, like in terms of joining with like-minded people to meet in community, to do acts of resistance, whether it was politically or institutionally. Anyway, so she would be like about taking action, not just talking. But then I think a third thing is she believes that the only way for resistance to be sustained powerfully is if it's mystical. And this is a very interesting point. She thinks that resistance without mysticism is likely to run out of steam or give up or become resigned. And I find that really thought provoking, because what she would want to do then is call upon people's innate mysticism to believe that the world can be better, and that there's a vision beyond, even if it's beyond our lifetime, that things will be better. And so there's a hope that she would call upon that can never be extinguished. And I think that to me is the most emotionally kind of charged part of her piece, which is the inner strength of mysticism.
Yeah, she speaks a lot about perception and vision, perceiving the pain of God,
mm-hmm.
Perceiving the forms of sin and the conditions of Torah perception. It's curious, I don't know what role mysticism played in the German resistance. I can give you anecdotal examples of resistance and members of the resistance and conspirators who had what we might consider sort of, you know, maintain contemplative disciplines, or who had kind of mystical dispositions. But mysticism as, you know, a spiritual practice is just not, as far as I know from what I've read, part of the repertoire of the German resistance. So did she ever speak about the resistance that was closest to her own story and relation to mysticism?
She did occasionally. However, I think your observation connects with that postscript, but where she and her husband debate the democratization of mysticism, because I think she considers mysticism as available to, you know, to all people of faith, different religions, everyday Christians. And I think based on her definition of mysticism in this book, it would not be difficult to find examples. I think Bonhoeffer is an example, for sure. And it doesn't, but it wouldn't matter to her. Does he admit to being a mystic, or does he self-identify as a mystic, or was he as mystical as, you know, John of the Cross? Like, she wouldn't ask that question. She would say that the evidence is clear of his mysticism based on his acceptance of suffering, his faith, his hope, his willingness to die. But I think, yeah, so I think to find examples of mysticism in the Holocaust, if you take her democratization, then there are many examples. If you're looking for like high-level mysticism, Simone Weil is a figure who Zola felt a deep affinity for, I would mention, and Bonhoeffer I would mention. I think for Zola, and I think Edith Stein would be an interesting figure if you were looking for like high kind of what I'm calling high level or like traditional forms of mysticism that are exceptional.
You know, for Bonhoeffer, it would certainly include a kind of mystical sensibility, but one that had to be understood through the, you know, razor sharp kind of precision of Christology.
Yes.
And the very particular claims of discipleship and costly grace.
Another thing, her comment on Martin Luther King Jr. is interesting because she says she didn't think he was a mystic, but then when she read about a certain experience he had at the kitchen table, then she thought, okay, he's a mystic. But like, why is that important? Like, to me, that seems like it seems like to be a mystic is a certain kind of faith in God. And it's not having like a euphoric moment.
Well, what's interesting about that King story that she tells,
that
was deeply transformative in his own theological self-understanding and engagement of the social order. So it happened in the second month of the Montgomery bus boycott.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, had not been particularly interested in taking over the presidency of the Montgomery Improvement Association. It was kind of persuaded that if he said yes, it would be over in a couple of days. His initial demands as the president of the Montgomery Improvement Association were so moderate, they didn't even challenge Jim Crow laws. And when King told his story of the Montgomery year and of his own, if I could put this in some old Southern Baptist, and I mean Southern Baptist in lower case, his relationship to Jesus, he would say that vision in the, you know, the midnight kitchen was a moment in which he felt called. He had been schooled, you know, at Boston University in the canon of philosophical theology of the German tradition, but there was a sense of calling that night that radicalized him. So after that experience, King said, I gave up the guns. Turns out that there was an arsenal in the parsonage, North Jackson Street, where King was minister of weapons. And he shortly thereafter made that extraordinary speech sermon on the steps of his parsonage in Montgomery after it was bombed. When he recognized that the movement that had been peaceful so far was on the verge of turning violent. And he invoked, you know, the teachings of Jesus, the kind of these radical dispositions of love that knows no limit. And he also kind of rethought the aims of the Montgomery bus boycott. He said, indeed, we are going after systemic, you know, sort of conditions of injustice. We're going to try to change the laws. And It was a moment, I think, that really beautifully illustrates the social power, the kind of powers of that mystical experience, that it was one in which he also felt a sense of release from having to carry the burden of the movement. He had a keener sense of participatory kind of, you know, work alongside the church. I mean, it was a really extraordinary moment. And maybe I sort of as a former Baptist, I overdetermined those singular experiences, you know, in ways that were familiar to us. But I thought it was a fantastic example.
Yeah, and I think it connects with egolessness that came up in one of the student questions. Like, it's leaving behind your ego and seeing yourself as part of a whole, like part of a collective.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
If I could chime in, Adam. Here. So I'm Adam King. I work over at Eastern Mennonite University as a graduate recruiter, and studied at Union actually for a STM a few years ago, where I was introduced to Zelle. And one of the things I'm kind of thinking about, because I haven't read her extensively, the work that I read of hers most was To Work in Love. And in that work, I think one of the things I see her doing is deconstructing this idea of a hierarchical creation, like creator and created, and seeing ourselves as like the pinnacle of creation. There's a movement towards the democratization. There's also this, I think the other thing to think about here is there's this movement towards liberation, and liberation theologians and liberation movements. And I would be interested in looking into where those liberation movements that have been successful or are even continuing today. Think about some of my friends and colleagues that I know in Palestine now, who are going through remarkable suffering and continue to hold out hope for a new world, despite the fact that the literal apocalypse is happening around them. And I'm always struck at when I hear them speak. Mitri Raheb is a favorite of mine, a Palestinian theologian, who talks about hope as planting olive seeds with the knowledge that the world's ending tomorrow. There's this sense through all of her works, as I am understanding it, that walking away from or in anything that creates a hierarchical kind of power structure is going to keep us from actually encountering the divine, and that the way to encounter the divine is to engage with one another, the I Thou, to engage with creation, with the world around us in more deeply powerful ways, instead of seeing ourselves as lord of it. And I wonder how much that connection to creation in particular and her kind of ecology connects to this mysticism, and if you have any thoughts on that.
Thank you,
Adam. Yeah, it, what you're saying, it's all there in the silent cry, implicit. And I really like the way that you lay that out. Part of her rejection of traditional theism is what you said, that the God-human hierarchy is wrong, and that theology needs to respond to that with new language for God. And the challenged hierarchy also explains her kind of her critique of social class and economic privilege and why she, you know, that she believes that justice involves sharing and solidarity and in her, she would call it socialism, I think, in her time, but whatever you call it, it would be a form of social organization where there weren't elites who controlled most of the resources. And I think, yeah, I think the question in my mind right now with the discussion is just whether the term mysticism applies to everything the way that she seems to employ it.
You know, it seems that what I'm most struck by after spending another week with Zula is her concern for this new language.
Mm-hmm.
A sense that, you know, Bonhoeffer wrote, the time of words is over. Our witness must be now limited to two things, prayer and righteous action. And a sense that the language of God has been so thoroughly profaned and co-opted, you know, by the powers and principalities, that that there need to be new sort of arcane disciplines in which the language of the tradition is preserved, but also explorations of a new kind of language. And so, you know, this is the silent cry is kind of a, it is kind of a writing into that new way of speaking. And it's also kind of a theater of voices, isn't it? I mean, she really just kind of breaks the kind of theological canon apart and invites voices into this conversation who have been, because of, you know, institutional practices, marginalized, if not silent. And so, you know, I think the book invites us, you know, to kind of try to find new ways of speaking, you know, in perhaps, you know, mindful of a richer, wider kind of, you know, cast of theological fellow travelers. I mean, do you think that's sort of one of the reasons that, you know, her writing has this kind of episodic, kind of more kind of even fragmentary quality, is that she's, you know, she's wanting to break down these kind of dominant rhetorical organizing, you know, structures of theological discourse, and opening this up again, language up again, opening it to voices that have been muted and marginalized, and not just as kind of homiletical, you know, curiosities, but of agents, you know, of theological wisdom and insight.
I think you put that so well. I what to add to that? I mean, I think Zola does want her theological writing to be a force of kind of disruption, or at least kind of, she wants to have kind of a unconventional approach, and whether it's literature, whether it's calling out, you know, the Christo-fascism, yeah, she tends toward extreme sayings, and I think she does want to disrupt theological language. And I do think she does associate the dogmatic theology with a hierarchical authoritarian system that that connects with what a few others have said too, that the whole system of authority includes theological doctrine, and it needs to be questioned and rejected as a system of dominance.
This has been, will you adult me one final question?
Okay.
I'm a huge fan of Sarah Pennock, and I was a huge fan of Clark Pennock. Your dad was my father's theology professor. Your father taught my uncle, who's a theologian. Your father taught another uncle, who's a Baptist minister. And they, and I followed the career of Clark Pennock with such admiration. This book on the Holy Spirit, it's just like a mind. Well, if I weren't in pleasant company, I might say a mind, you know, that word. Okay. You know what I mean? It just really blew my mind. And it made me want to speak in tongues, even though I never have and probably couldn't. It's just a gorgeous book. And the courage of your father in his, you know, his move into this kind of open theism and a reconsideration of evangelical soteriology and the like. What would your father have said if he maybe said something of Zola's vocation and of her work?
He attended an event that I spoke at, which was the year after she died, and he found her. I think he was most interested in her as a German who was responding to the Holocaust and World War II. So he found her very moving as far as her critique of the church and the German, you know, the German church. So he, I don't know. I think, so I think he would, yeah, he was an admirer of her for her willingness to call out theology when it needed it, you know, to be kind of, to just bravely say what needed to be said. I think he did that as an evangelical when he disagreed with other evangelicals. And he admired Zola for doing that against, you know, against the institutional church. And he admired her what he would have thought seen as her ecumenical kind of acceptance of you know, all churches and religious traditions.
That's beautiful. I'm really warmed to hear this. Well, Dr. Pennant, Sarah, thank you so much for this extraordinary time. Thanks for going 15 minutes over. Lauren, can we be in touch? I'd love to hear more about your dissertation. And to all of our guests, thank you for joining us. Many thanks again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.